Thank you. So this is a recent work done with Gautam Satishchandran, who's currently a grad student at UChicago. He'll be starting his postdoc at Princeton next year, and Bob Wald. So let me, and I want to preface, if people have questions, feel free to just interrupt me, even if I don't see some hand raising emoji thing on the Zoom interface. Okay, so what are we actually trying to look at? We're trying to look at scattering in field theory in an asymptotically flat spacetime. Mostly I'll be doing Minkowski, except when I do nonlinear gravity, this really will be an asymptotically flat spacetime and not just Minkowski for obvious reasons. Okay, so what I want to look at is the following. So we want to consider some generic scattering of particles or fields from past infinity to future infinity. So here's a schematic cartoon diagram that Gautam actually drew up. So what I've done here is conformally compactified Minkowski spacetime and added all the boundaries at infinity. So for example, there's the past time-like infinity, and this is where all the massive fields start out from. So these whorl lines are, you can imagine them as massive particle whorl lines going in. And there's past null infinity, which is usually where you send in massless fields like electromagnetism or gravitational fields. And then they interact in some probably very complicated way. And the massive fields go out to future time-like infinity, but then they can also emit a lot of massless radiation, which goes out to future null infinity. And for later purposes, we'll also need some spatial infinity, which you can think of as far away at t equals zero surface, and that's a two-sphere. I'll use theta for two-sphere coordinates in everything I'm talking about, but you should really imagine it as theta phi, so there are two coordinates, but I'll just use the theta part of the whole thing. Okay, so what actually happens in any non-trivial scattering process is that the radiation field has a long time tail or a zero frequency part, which is classically the memory effect. So as an example, if you look at electromagnetic radiation coming out at say future null infinity, and you have the angular coordinate theta and u is the retarded time coordinate at null infinity. And if you look at the vector potential, it'll start at some value. Then because there's some radiation, it'll wiggle around, do something complicated. And in the far future, when u goes to plus infinity, which is approaching this way, it won't go back to the same value that it started with. And this difference between the initial value and the final value, I mean, the initial and final ones are computed technically as u goes to plus and minus infinity. So these are really, really long time tails. The value doesn't go back to itself, and the difference in that value is basically the memory effect, which I'm denoting by delta. And the same thing happens, don't worry about the other symbols, I'll explain them when I get to you. And similar things will happen with gravitational waves. You'll see some wiggles, kind of like a LIGO signal, and then generic scattering processes, it won't go back to itself. In genuine LIGO experiments, this delta is expected to be really tiny. So currently we don't see it in LIGO because, I mean, this just looks like it went back to zero because it's supposed to be very, very tiny. And, you know, since this is a very long time effect, you know, LIGO hasn't been started on forever and it doesn't see very, very low frequencies essentially. So we can't astrophysically observe this right now, but there are people, very clever people, working on at least looking at this in numerical simulations of black hole coalescence and seeing what happens, what the waveform looks like, so we can actually observe it in LIGO in the future or with other detectors like LISA. And this classical memory effect has been known actually for a quite long time and has been pretty well studied. But it also shows up when you do the quantum theory. And so I'll start with a simple theory where I'll explain what kind of things we can do and progressively build up to nonlinear general relativity. So the easiest case to handle is massive QED. So you have some massive charged scalar field, phi, and it's coupled to electromagnetism. And you can figure out how the field, the scalar field phi, behaves as it approaches time-like infinities. So in the massive future and past. And it basically is described by its Fourier transforms. So these are sort of positive negative frequency parts, and there are actually four of them because this is actually a complex scalar field because it's charged. And don't worry about remembering these symbols. This is just the only place where they'll show up because the interesting stuff actually happens with the massless fields, not the massive stuff. So basically you can write these as functions of P, where P is basically a future directed momentum. Time-like momentum. So it lies on some unit hyperboloid. And this is the usual Fourier description of a massive scalar field. And you can quantize, you have a phase space, you can quantize this and play the standard game with the massive fields. Okay, but what happens with the electromagnetic field? The electromagnetic field will actually go towards null infinity, so scry plus minus. And I've written sort of the asymptotic falloffs. And the main part is sort of the spherical components. So capital indices will always be spherical components, or you can think of them as polarization vectors components if you want. That will fall off as 1/r, but there'll be a leading order term, which is a function of both the retarded time and the angles. And the radiation really is described by this gauge invariant electric field, which is just the time derivative of this vector potential in this fall off conditions. And as I was mentioning, the electromagnetic memory then is the difference between the far future and far past limits of this thing. And it's more convenient to write it as an integral of the electric field just by using this equation, modulo sines, that I might have gotten wrong in the slide, but won't matter. And usually this memory effect is non-zero. And again, classically, you can build up a phase space at null infinity. So it's an asymptotic phase space. And you can describe your degrees of freedom just with this electric field. And you have Poisson brackets of observables and all that classically. And now you can ask, okay, can we just directly quantize this classical phase space at null infinity? And this was explained a long time ago by Abhay Ashtekar, actually even before the word memory effect, I think, was in the lexicon. And it's kind of the standard story where you take your classical field, which I'll take to be the electric field, and update it to a quantum operator value distribution. And I'm using boldface for these operator kind of objects. And it's a distribution because we know usually quantum fields are singular at small distances, so you really have to smear them out and so on. But I'll be a bit sloppy and just treat it as a function of u and theta. And you can find commutation relations from the Poisson brackets and so on, which I've not written down here. And you do find a Poincaré invariant vacuum state. This is some state that lives on null infinity, which is completely Poincaré invariant. And it's effectively specified by its two-point function, which is of this form at null infinity. This is the limit of the bulk two-point function to null infinity using the fall-off conditions for the radiation. And this QAB is the metric on the two-sphere. Okay, so we have a vacuum. And we can also build a one-photon Hilbert space. So we start with some test wave functions. And these have indices because, again, you can have polarizations, or you can think of them as coordinate indices of some vector on a sphere. And from this two-point function, you can just figure out what the one particle norm is supposed to be, and I've written it out here. The angular integration is not really that important for what I'm going to say. So here I've converted the u coordinate to a frequency coordinate using Fourier transform, the standard Fourier transform story. And the integral goes from zero to infinity because I've taken sort of the positive frequency part of this wave function. And this is all fine and good. And one can check that this again is the limit of the bulk one particle Hilbert space inner product. But now what happens is if your wave function actually has memory, so it doesn't go to the same initial and final values, then the memory will show up as the coefficient of a diverging part in frequency. And if you, and this is rough, I mean, there are higher order terms, but the memory shows up in this guy. And if you put this 1/omega object in here, you can see that you'll get a d omega by omega, and that this integral is logarithmically divergent unless the memory is zero. So what actually happens is we have a whole Hilbert space of all these photon states, but none of these states actually have memory. So the standard Fock space does not describe these quantum field degrees of freedom when there's some non-zero memory effect. And this really is an issue for trying to do scattering theory, because even if your in states did not have any memory, so they were perfectly fine objects in the standard Fock space, if there's some non-trivial interaction, your out state will have some memory. And then you don't have that state in this Hilbert space. So you can't write that as some S matrix mapping this Fock space to itself. But this really isn't a ginormous problem, because you can actually find other Hilbert spaces where the memory states live. And the idea is to use coherent states which are peaked at some classical solution with memory. So I'll use the script A for this classical solution, and it has, say, some memory delta. And the way to construct these coherent states is to take your original electric field operator, or you can rewrite this in terms of creation annihilation operators if you'd like, and then shift it by this classical solution times the identity operator. And because you've shifted by something that's classical times the identity, all your commutation relations are preserved by this new operator. So your operator algebra is not changing. And this transformation really is an automorphism of the field algebra. But this automorphism is actually not unitarily implemented in the standard Fock space. What you actually do get is a new Hilbert space of states. So I'm just writing it as F delta. Delta being zero was the standard Fock space. But in F sub delta, all states now have the memory of your chosen classical solution. And really, this doesn't depend on which classical solution you picked, but if, as long as you keep the same memory. So, you know, F delta will be unitarily equivalent to F delta prime if and only if delta equals delta prime. So two classical solutions can be very different, but as long as they have the same memory, they determine the same memory Fock space. And if they have different memories, they determine completely unitarily inequivalent Hilbert spaces for your operator algebra. And I want to emphasize that this really is equality as functions, not as numbers. So functions on a sphere. So what that means is for every function on a sphere, you get a different unitarily inequivalent Hilbert space. And there are uncountably many inequivalent Hilbert spaces. So we started with zero memory and said that that Hilbert space was not sufficient to do scattering. And so we added memory, and now we have uncountably many inequivalent Hilbert spaces. So we have a lot and lot of states which do have memory, but that causes other problems for scattering in the sense that if you start with some in Hilbert space with, say, some memory, you generically do not a priori know which out Hilbert space memory you're going to end up in. And I'm going to point that out with a few examples. So you can do a simple case of electromagnetism with no sources. And this really is the trivial case, because there's no interaction. Electromagnetism doesn't interact with itself. I think Laurent has his hand raised, so I'll stop here.
Yeah, I have a question. Can you go back behind what, when you say, you know, I mean, okay, in the usual description, they're unitarily equivalent, but I don't see why you can't, you know, introduce an operator that translates the memory, like the Goldstone operator that just also affects the EA. It might be complicated, but I don't see this conclusion as being robust that they have to be an equivalent, right? Don't you want to add an extra mode and it's conjugate to the phase space so that you can rotate these different Hilbert space into one another?
No, so you can do that, but then you'll have to do that, I will claim, in a Lorentz invariant way. And there doesn't exist any. I mean, we showed that there doesn't exist. So essentially, let me explain how that would work. So, you know, in some sense, you want an operator that's conjugate to the memory, right?
Yeah.
So usually, I mean, so if we go back to, say, quantum mechanics, right? And you have, you know, something that's labeled by x-axis, and you have its canonical conjugate, which is the momentum, which acts as, you know, shifting between different values of x. And that's what you really kind of want to do. But to set up an actual Hilbert space, you have to look for the analog of the standard quantum mechanics Hilbert space, which is, you know, L2 functions on the real line. So here you'll have to integrate in the memory values. And that's an infinite dimensional integral. And you have to define the measure space sort of carefully so that you actually do, and I mean, so that your conjugate momentum operator actually is represented on that algebra. And it's not possible. I mean, we show in the paper that it's not possible to do that in a Lorentz invariant way.
Okay, so you mean because you're restricting the, so you're still restricting to have only one vacua, right? So it's okay.
No. I'm including all of these deltas.
Okay.
They just live in different.
You'll say more what you mean by the inner Lorentz invariant way. I agree that once you have these other Coulombic vacua, some more Lorentz invariants is to. Yeah, okay, you have to let go of something.
Right. Yeah, if you can let, you're allowed to let go of Lorentz invariants, but then you don't know that the spin of the photon is, you know, one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I would think that's, you don't want to let go of Lorentz invariances. That would be at least my take on it.
Yeah, not incontrollably, but maybe you're going to explain a bit more how you... Okay.
It might come up later. I mean, I sort of skipped that because it's kind of a technical mathematical point, but we can discuss it again at the end if you'd like.
Yeah, I won't be able to stay there, but that.
Oh, okay.
Okay, sorry. Just.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. Thank you for the answer.
Yeah.
Sorry. So here, this memory you're saying you're just using a classical number for this memory. Yeah. Why it's not a wave function as well? This right, this electric field is a wave function, but why is the memory a number?
Correct, because in this construction, the way the memory was constructed is it's the memory of this classical object. So you start with zero memory, but you shift it with a classical object and you get all these representations. So what you're asking, I mean, is also, I mean, really accurate, is that generically, if you have a quantum wave function or something, it should also have a spread or fluctuation in the memory. But here I'm saying, oh, this is some fixed number in each Hilbert space. And that actually relates to Lorentz's question is, if you knew how to integrate over these objects, so, you know, you have a Hilbert space for each label, delta, but if you had a way of integrating over all deltas to form a big Hilbert space, sort of stitch all these Hilbert spaces together, then you would have wave functions which have fluctuations in the memory also. But as I was telling Laurent, there isn't any Lorentz invariant way of doing that. There are many ways of doing that, and they're all not Lorentz invariant.
Okay, I see. Thanks.
Okay, so going back to the specific cases. So if we look at just free electromagnetism where there's no scattering, nothing really happens. So if you send in some in-memory state, again, here I'm just using this as a classical label. So this is a definite value of memory. And you take... So the out memory that you will get is just directly related to the in memory by sort of an antipodal map. So here, minus theta basically will be the point opposite on a two sphere to the original point that you started with. I'll mention where these conservation laws really come from in a sort of more general situation. Or you can do electromagnetism with a classical source. And in that case, this is just changed by, again, a classical current term. So once you start with some in memory, because the classical current is fixed, you know exactly what out memory you're going to. So here you can actually write down some scattering operator because you know exactly which in given an in Hilbert space, you know exactly which out Hilbert space you're going to, and so you can write down that map, or the map will be well defined and not IR divergent or whatever, which I'll come to next. But the case that we really want to look at is, what if you have a quantum field that acts as a source for the electromagnetic field? And in that, I mean, this is related to the previous points that were brought up, is if you start with some in memory, because now your current term is also quantum, it has its own quantum fluctuations floating around, there is no definite out memory state that you can get into. And this is exactly what Juan was asking, is why are we restricting to definite memories? And we cannot, is my point, is you can start with a definite memory state in the in state, but your out state then will be completely randomly spread out, and it won't have any definite out memory. So it won't live in any one of these Hilbert spaces. And the standard approach is to just pretend that all states are in the standard Fock space, and write down some S matrix and do these calculations. But then the S matrix sort of diverges, because, which is the infrared divergence, and it diverges precisely because even if you start with zero memory, you won't end up with zero memory. And as I was saying, that state has some logarithmic divergence, and that doesn't lie in your Fock, in your original Fock space. So this is basically the content of the Weinberg-Soft theorem, is that your S matrix has a pole, which is exactly the one over frequency pole. But that really arises because you're trying to scatter into another Hilbert space, which is not your original one that you wanted. So a bunch of these things, though, sort of give us at least some rough idea, which is that, at least in the simple cases, if we have some conserved quantity, so if you build your Hilbert space not on this memory object, which isn't conserved generically, but if you actually have some genuine conserved quantity and you start to build your Hilbert space using that, then we might get somewhere. And before I go, I'll pause if there are any more questions. Okay, so what are these conserved quantities that I'm talking about? And these are sort of the charges at spatial infinity. So for example, in electromagnetism, this is related to a whole story about asymptotic symmetries and so on, but that's a whole another hour long talk. So I'll just sort of get to what the actual punchline of that would be, is at spatial infinity, you actually have an infinite number of charges, which you can think of as generators of these large gauge symmetries at infinity. And they're defined on this two sphere at spatial infinity. And they're actually related to the charges that you would send in from time-like infinity using your massive fields and the memory of any incoming radiation that you could send in. And the same kind of equation holds also on the out future side. And there's that D is the divergence or derivative operator on two sphere. And it was conjectured by Strominger that the charge at spatial infinity in the in thing is related to the out charge via this antipodal map I was talking about. And this has been shown, this has been actually proven now in many, many different contexts, and especially in electromagnetism in flat space time, this really does work. And there's an analog of this in general relativity in certain situations. So if we can find Hilbert spaces of a fixed charge, not fixed memory, but fixed charge, then that would be guaranteed. So if you start with some in state, you will know exactly what out charge you're going to, just from the conservation law. And this will be guaranteed in any situation, even in massive QED or massless QED, in fact, or gravity, actually. So how does one go about constructing this definite Hilbert space thing? And that is related to this very old construction by Fadeev and Kulish of dress states. And the way one does this is the following. So you start with some improper momentum state of the massive field. So some n number of particles whose momenta is p through pn, and n number of antiparticles with some momenta q through qn. And I've taken both particle number and antiparticle number to be equal, at least for this slide, because I'm going to set the charge to zero just for simplicity. And you can calculate basically what the charge contribution at time like infinity will be. Essentially, you start with the constant Coulomb charge of a stationary field, and then you boost it to whatever momentum you want. So P1 through Pn for your particles and Q1 through Qn for your antiparticles. And you just sum all those boosted Coulomb charges. And that charge object will depend on the angle and also on the incoming momenta of the particles that you sent in. So this is some improper state of definite charge at time like infinity, but that's not the conserved quantity. We actually want the charge at spatial infinity. So what we really do, so I'm going to look at the case where we set the charge at spatial infinity to be exactly zero, because that's sort of simpler to explain, which is why I set the particle and antiparticle number to be equal. So we'll take this state and we'll pair it up with any electromagnetic state which has memory, but the memory will now be determined by demanding that the charge at spatial infinity is zero. So we sent in some charges at time like infinity, and we'll choose our memory so that we'll cancel that charge completely and get the zero charge at spatial infinity. And there's a unique solution to this equation for the memory. So we then take our momentum states, tensor in some state, some electromagnetic state, which has the memory that we already found by, you know, solving this equation on a two-sphere. And then because these are improper states, we'll smear it with some wave function and integrate over all the momenta. And this is usually called a dressed state, because you've taken your particles and antiparticles and put some photon clothes on them. And this will have zero charge. This any state of this kind before any n will have zero charge at spatial infinity. And I want to emphasize in this whole thing is, given the particle and antiparticle momenta, there's no unique photon state that you're putting on it. The only thing that is uniquely determined is the memory. And within that memory, you can put on any photon state. The whole thing will just have zero charge at spatial infinity for any psi. And all of these states will live in this one gigantic Hilbert space, which is the Fadeev-Coolidge Hilbert space. And you also have to direct sum over particle number and antiparticle number. For example, the massive vacuum tensor photon vacuum is obviously in this thing because that has zero energy. So n is zero and you just put the vacuum here, for example. And this has a lot of states, and these are sort of the states of zero charge at spatial infinity. And then again, charge conservation actually ensures that this Hilbert space will scatter to itself. So if you start with any state of this form in your in state, because the charge is conserved, the out state will also lie in the same Hilbert space. And so the S matrix for these kinds of states, where you just map this Hilbert space to itself, is completely well-defined without any IR divergences. I'll pause here for a second if people have questions, before I tell you why this isn't very satisfactory as a picture, even though it tells you that there exists an S matrix or something.
Lauren has a question.
Yeah, maybe you're going to say that next. Can you say a bit more? As you say, there's an ambiguity, right? So there's a bundle of possible Fadeev-Coolidge dressing. So now the question is whether this ambiguity couples to the S matrix or not, or does it decouple in your formulation there? Can you say a bit more about that?
Are you talking about the fact that I said you can use any psi?
Yeah, exactly. So suppose you take two states which have the same dressing, different psi. Why do I get different S matrices, etc.? Do I have an equivalence or a symmetry that makes that well defined?
Correct. Okay. So in this picture, if you can, so we fix the memory. Okay. So let's fix the memory part. So the zero frequency part of this state has completely been fixed by the momentum of the incoming particles. Now, if you consider two different wave functions which have the same zero frequency part, their difference really doesn't have any memory. So those you can, you can think of those as actual hard photons in quotes. Mm-hmm. So different choices of dressings, essentially, so different choices of soft dressing differ by a choice of hard photon. And essentially, I mean, you can sort of close your eyes then, and I mean, the S matrix you get by starting with different size is not the same, because you're giving in different in states, so you won't get the same amplitude for the out state. But you can scatter, you can choose any one that you want, and you can write, there'll be a whole, you could write, compute an S matrix for all of them, but they will be different S matrix amplitudes for different dressings, because they differ by a hard photon, which can then interact with your particle. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that answers. But can't you just try to maybe take a section of this bundle of ambiguities and, you know, based on symmetry, I'm thinking maybe what people are like conformal, you know, like take the conformal cloud or if you're talking about Lorentz invariant, things like that. Is there trying to minimize that ambiguity?
I understand what you're saying. I think in this, if you want to stick to this Hilbert space, I think it's not possible. Mm-hmm. Because you want to preserve the fact, I mean, you know, for example, you can think of, oh, why can't I integrate over all possible dressings or something? Just as a made up example, I mean, it doesn't work, because then you're integrating out all the hard photons that you sent in, right? And that will give you a quantity, that's okay. But then you're sort of playing the game where you've sort of integrated out some hard degrees of freedom in your S matrix, and then you have to make sure all of this works and so on and so forth. So it's kind of pretty annoying. And I don't think it quite works.
But I was asking about a section, like maybe this trivial, you know, have you thought about that? Like picking a unique representative based on some symmetry argument. Maybe the bundle is non-trivial and it's not possible. There's an obstruction.
Yeah, okay. We can talk about local sections. So, I mean, we don't need to get into the topology of this infinite dimensional bundle or something, right? So even locally, I would, like I was saying, you know, different choices of dressings differ by a hard photon. And there isn't a unique one, because it really is an affine space, and you're trying to pick an origin. Just at a point. I mean, I'm talking even at a fixed point, right? The fiber is an affine space without a choice of origin, and you're trying to pick a choice of origin. And symmetries don't help you, because the symmetries do act fiber-wise, except Lorentz symmetry. But then the only Lorentz invariant choice you have, I mean, because the memory itself is not Lorentz invariant, mm-hmm. even if you make a choice at one point of your bundle, it won't translate to another one, because the memory isn't invariant under Lorentz transformations.
Okay. Okay, maybe we can talk about it. I thought there was a proposal by Strominger, Reclero, where they tried mm-hmm. to argue that you can take a conformally invariant clouds.
I've read that argument, and I mean, I'm doing everything at null infinity where the electromagnetic field is completely conformally invariant. So I actually don't understand that argument.
Okay. Well, maybe Anna can explain later.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to make the point that this Hilbert space is not very nice anyway. So I don't want to spend a lot of time fixing the Hilbert space that doesn't work. Are there any questions about this part? Okay, so we have a Hilbert space, but it's a very, very artificial Hilbert space. I mean, also for reasons that Laurent was pointing out. For example, the total charge, the standard bog standard Coulombic charge of your scalar field cannot be dressed away, because the memory that you're adding is always sort of L greater than one harmonic. But so you can't dress away the constant function. So this is why secretly in the previous slide, I set the total charge to zero. So you always need to send an equal number of particles and antiparticles. And there's a whole history of looking at this, and it goes by the name of hiding particles behind the moon. So if your experimental friend wants to, you know, try to scatter two electrons, and he asks you for the calculation, if you want to be in this Hilbert space, you secretly have to hide two positrons behind the moon or in your back pocket so your friend doesn't see them. And then you do the calculation, and then you pull back, throw away the positrons, and then tell them the answer or something. So it's a very artificial way of doing this. But like I was saying, you can repeat that construction for any value of this charge function. And you get a Hilbert space for every value of this charge function. And each value of the charge function gives you, again, a unitarily inequivalent Hilbert space, just like you had for memory. So now you'll have Hilbert spaces labeled by charge functions. And all those are actually good because each Hilbert space will then scatter into the same value of the charge. So you still have a lot more control compared to the case where the Hilbert spaces were labeled by memory functions. But then this isn't Lorentz invariant, unless the charge value was set to zero. Because if you Lorentz boost this charge, it maps to some completely different charge function and a different Hilbert space. So if you take a non-zero value of charge, the angular momentum and spin of these states is completely undefined. And again, there's a long history of this kind of story where people, it's claimed that, you know, Lorentz really is spontaneously broken. But I would say it's not broken at the level of the operator algebra. You're just choosing Hilbert spaces, and it's not unitarily implemented in that Hilbert space. And the last point is that your massive fields always come with some radiative photon cloud. And it's related to this uniqueness thing for the choice of this dressing that Laurent was mentioning is you cannot scatter an electron and a positron. You always have to send in some photon radiation if you want to live in this Hilbert space. You can hide that photon cloud at very, very low frequencies because the whole point of dressing is to get the zero frequency part correct. And again, there's no unique one as far as I know, but you always have to send in some photon cloud. And this photon cloud actually completely decoheres all the states in the Fadeev-Coolidge Hilbert space. So you're not allowed to do any interference experiments with the states in this Hilbert space. And this is this decoherence story was recently figured out by Gautam and Bob Wald, and they're writing it up. And in sort of a different related work, at least in massive QED, you can actually fix all these issues. Like Lorentz isn't really spontaneously broken. You can figure out how to stitch these charges together in some Lorentz invariant way, in a very special way, which was different from the memory case that I was talking about before. And then you don't have, there are states where you don't have to send in some photon cloud in those Hilbert spaces, but they're not in a Fadeev-Coolidge Hilbert space. Okay, so are there any questions about this? Because now I'll move on to, I mean, I've shown that there exists at least one Hilbert space where the S matrix exists for massive QED, but it has its own issues. And now I'll move on to other cases where nothing actually works. So I'll pause here if there are more questions about this. Okay, so massive QED has at least one construction, actually secretly more, but you'll have to wait for the paper to come out. Let's do massless QED. The difference in massless QED, so you get the same story with, oh, there are many, many memory spaces and so on and so forth. But I want to see, can we do the Fadeev-Coolidge construction? And again, I'm just taking zero charge for definiteness. The same thing holds even if you take some non-zero charge for the Fadeev-Coolidge construction. The difference that happens is because you're not sending in any massive fields now, all your charged fields are also massless. You actually get a current term at null infinity instead of some time charge coming in from time like infinity in your conservation law. And you can try to repeat the Fadeev-Kulesh construction by demanding that the total charge is zero, and then you try to solve for the memory. But for a definite momentum state, which is massless quantum field, the current actually is a delta function in the angles. And here p hat is the angular direction that your null particle is coming in. And if you try to solve this equation, it actually implies that the memory diverges in the coincident limit when the angle of the memory that you're computing the memory at is coincides with the angle that your null particle is coming in. And this is related to the collinear divergences that people find in massless QED. And it would be fine if this divergence just existed, and we'll see a case where it's okay. But the problem really is that this memory is not square integrable on the sphere. So this divergence is not an integrable divergence in on a two sphere in the memory. So you can construct these states, you can construct the dressing, but because of this funny behavior, what really happens is the photon dressing has infinite energy. So you started with perfectly okay massless fields, which had perfectly finite energy. And to go into to do the Fadeev-Kulesh construction, you had to dress them. But the dressing came with an infinite amount of energy. So the Fadeev-Kulesh construction just completely fails in massless QED. And again, this fact is not tied to the thing that this is in zero charge. This will happen for any charge. The singular structure still remains. So I would say even in massless QED, I don't know of any asymptotic Hilbert space that's good for scattering. Because any definite charge space you would like to construct will be bad and has this infinite photon dressing as energy. And a similar thing happens in linearized gravity, but it's kind of better. You can do linearized gravity with massive fields, but then it's the same story that I gave you in detail with QED. So now instead of the electric field at null infinity, the radiative field really is the nuce. And you also have gravitational memory, which is a similar formula, the integral of the nuce from past infinity to future infinity. And this is a symmetric traceless tensor for people paying very close attention. And you can try to do the Fadeev-Kulesh kind of construction in this case. And there's a similar conservation law where the charges now are basically charges related to super translations at null infinity. And I'll explain this part in a bit. And again, instead of a charge current, you get some stress energy flux from your massless source. And the important point really is you get two derivatives of the memory in this charge conservation law. And you want to set that to zero or basically any particular value. Here I've gone with L greater than equal to two because L equals zero and one really is the four momentum charge. And unlike in electromagnetism, you don't have objects with negative mass. So you can't actually cancel them just by adding correct number of antiparticles or there's no anti-mass basically. So we're only going to set the L greater than equal to two parts to vanish and just see what happens. And you get a similar delta function singularity in your source. This is exactly the same as happened for the current. But because you had two derivatives, the memory only diverges as a logarithm. So this is still a collinear divergence. The memory does diverge when theta becomes equal to the angle that your particles are coming in. But this actually is L2 on the sphere. The divergence is much, much weaker. And your dressing now has finite energy. So again, it looks like, okay, we have constructed a Hilbert space. And we have. And I'm again going to appeal to Lorentz invariance because this condition really needed to be restricted to the higher harmonics. And that isn't Lorentz invariant because you can start with something that only has zero and one harmonics. And if you Lorentz boost it, you'll pick up the higher harmonics. So even though these states have finite energy, their angular momentum and spin is just completely undefined. Are there any questions? Because I'll jump to nonlinear gravity where nothing works. Okay. And this whole program is basically killed off in nonlinear GR. The Fadeev-Kulish construction just completely fails. And the asymptotic phase space is actually very similar to linearized gravity. And you also have a charge formula, except instead of a stress energy source, now it's the gravitational field which is sourcing itself. And this you might recognize from the Bondi mass formula. And you still get two derivatives of the memory. And the whole construction with memory Hilbert spaces still exists, and it still has the same issue that memory really isn't conserved. So you have these bunch of Hilbert spaces floating around. And the really main point is because the source itself is gravity, remember what we were previously doing. We were starting with the source, using that to and using the massless field to dress the source so that we got zero charge or whatever value of charge we wanted. But now because the source itself is gravity, every time you try to dress this term, you want to pick some memory, but that memory comes with its own new tensor, and that new tensor feeds back into this. And really, what we really show in the paper is if you want a fixed charge, any state with fixed charge value, it can be any charge value that you want. The only regular state that is, you know, it's Hadamard, so it's close coincident point singularities are just like a standard Minkowski free field. Then only such nice state is the vacuum whose charge actually is zero. So it's basically Minkowski spacetime. And there's no scattering and nothing because you only have one charge Hilbert, only one state in your Hilbert space. So there's no non-vacuum state in any Fadeev-Kulish Hilbert space. And so this is the Fadeev-Kulish construction just completely bombs in nonlinear gravity. And here's sort of a summary of the list of things I was mentioning is, you know, in massive QED, Fadeev construction kind of works and it's kind of promising, but you have all these problems with infinite angular momentum, hiding particles behind the moons and so on. And you progressively get worse until you reach nonlinear GR where the Fadeev-Kulish construction simply doesn't work. The point that Laurent was bringing up is what we tried to do was, I think exactly the kind of construction one would want is even if the Fadeev in nonlinear GR, for example, even if the Fadeev-Kulish construction does not work at all, we still have all these memory Hilbert spaces. So can we stitch together these memory Hilbert spaces in some way? And we show that there's actually, I mean, you can do this, but you cannot do it in any Lorentz invariant way. And I want to point out that the whole problem in this whole game really was that we were asking for a single Hilbert space to do our scattering. That's the real big issue. The operator algebra is completely fine. It's acted on by symmetries. It maps to itself, all of that. And there's a huge supply of states which are completely well-defined as correlation functions. The issue really, really, really is that you cannot force all your in and out states that are relevant for scattering into one big Hilbert space. Okay, so what should we do? And this is the last slide, so hopefully we have good time for discussion. So you can define your in and out states as a list of correlation functions. So the way you would specify a state omega is just give me all correlation functions of all the operators in your theory in that state. If you give me such a state, it will live in some Hilbert space, but not all states will live in the same Hilbert space. It's possible for two different states of this kind, two different correlation functions to define completely different Hilbert spaces. But we don't need a Hilbert space. You can just call the dollar map. I mean, I'm distinguishing this from an S matrix and its notation borrowed from Hawking's paper as a map between in correlation functions and out correlation functions. And you can sort of do standard stuff like conservation of probability and no information loss and just impose that on your dollar matrix. So this is just some completely abstract definition and it's sort of guaranteed to work in a certain sense. The question is, how do you actually practically compute what this in and out thing would be for your given favorite theory? And right now I just have to go, I don't know, because usual methods like Feynman diagrams, LSZ reduction don't really work because they assume that all states live in a single Hilbert space with an invariant vacuum. And Hawking has a 1976 paper where he introduces this dollar matrix, which has some very nice ideas related to sort of Euclidean path integrals and so on. But he still assumes there's a single Hilbert space in which, and all those states live in a single Hilbert space, but maybe it's possible to generalize this. So basically my point is, standard S matrix theory in gravity will completely fail because we just don't know what Hilbert space to start with. So we should use states as correlation functions, which are always completely well-defined. And we shouldn't take a vacation yet because there's more work to do. Thanks.
Thank you, Kartik, for the very nice talk. Any questions?
That means either it was very clear or very unclear.
Maybe I can start with one. So you mentioned about this, the massive QED case, and it still works out and it solves all other problem. Can you just explain a bit more how you would?
These problems that one should fix or something. So we're still in the middle of figuring out, but roughly the idea is the following. The charge equals zero case is the standard for Dieff-Kulisch construction, and we already kind of did that. The real problem it comes with, you know, something like this, where you want non-zero charge value, but if you fix that charge value, that Hilbert space is not Lorentz invariant and you don't have angular momentum and spin of any of your states. That really is the problem we were trying to look at. And it actually turns out what you can do is you start with some value of charge and you Lorentz boost it and Lorentz rotate it around, and you'll get a whole bunch of different charge values. And each of those charge values will have some Hilbert space on it, just like the standard for Dieff-Kulisch construction. But because you obtained all these charge values by boosting and rotating a single one, there actually is a nice way of integrating all of them together. So you squeeze all of them into one big Hilbert space, and each of these fixed charge values are actually just fibers in that Hilbert space at a single charge value point. And that also is guaranteed to map into itself under scattering, because each charge value maps into itself under scattering. So that's the rough idea. We still have to figure out the details. And you actually solve, surprisingly, to my surprise, you can solve the third part automatically if you've done the second part, because these stitched together Hilbert spaces will actually have electron states which don't need any dressed radiative photon cloud in them. But again, I should point out, these are completely different Hilbert spaces from the original Dieff-Kulisch construction.
I see. So at the end, you were talking about this nonlinear GR stuff, and you're saying, I guess we don't have a solution yet, but then you're saying that you should use this correlation of operators or seems like that. So are you suggesting that we should drop this, S matrix, like states description, and use some
arbitrary? So what I'm saying is, you know, the standard way of defining an S matrix is to start with some in and out Hilbert spaces, and then you write some S matrix map between them, and you can write them as amplitudes, basically. The problem there is the Hilbert space part. That's what I'm claiming. If you think instead of an S matrix as the, I mean, I've used a different notation, but it really is I think a different way of thinking of an S matrix is, instead of mapping Hilbert space states to the fixed Hilbert space state, which we don't know, we instead map some in-correlation function to an out-correlation function. So it's kind of a different way of thinking about an S matrix that doesn't involve a priori knowing what Hilbert space you want. So it's more like a reformulation. I'm not saying we should throw out everything that we already know.
I cannot imagine how that could be done, but okay.
That's why I put the shruggy thing, because I don't know either.
any other questions for Kardik?
Hi, I have comments, questions. Mm-hmm. I like your message a lot that it's the Hilbert spaces that are problematic. I just wonder if already we have a solution, which is just to do path integrals in a non-S matrix setting. For example, I think in lattice QCD, people study finite volume scatterings. And I guess there's nothing conceptually non-trivial, if I understood correctly. Mm-hmm. We can just, have a space-time region that's finite and then enumerate other path integral configurations and do the calculations.
Oh, no, absolutely. So that's why in my last slide, I pointed out this paper by Hawking, where he tries to do this kind of dollar operator thing. And he is sort of proposing that we use a Euclidean path integral to compute something like this. Mm-hmm. But, he was dealing with how to formulate information loss or something like that during black hole evaporation. So he still assumed there's a single Hilbert space, but I think there's I don't know how to do it yet, but I agree with you that there's a strong way of, it's possible that you can actually use some path integral way of really computing and writing what these quantities actually are without Hilbert space mechanisms.
Yes, yes. Just enumerate the configurations and the classified configurations at the boundary.
Yeah. It's very likely, it's possible that line of track is fruitful, but I don't know how to do that yet. So I'm not going to give you a strong yes, but I will say it's definitely worth investigating.
I guess I want to push you a little bit and be stimulating. Maybe we know how to do it. It's just enumerate the configuration without Hilbert spaces.
You mean the in and out states?
So we have a bounded region of space-time and region here,
here it's not bounded. Here it's all at infinity.
Right.
Because in gravity, right? We don't know how to do bulk quantum gravity, which is why sort of I went to infinity, where we do know how to do the quantization at infinity, but we don't know what's happening in the bulk.
Certainly we know a lot about the infinity.
Yes.
I'm not sure I agree 100%. We don't know how to do bulk quantum gravity.
That also depends on your flavor of quantum gravity then. But yeah, I want it to be, everything I said is kind of agnostic about what really the bulk quantum gravity theory looks like, is sort of a better way of saying it.
Yeah, I guess whatever approach you take, there are lots of approaches. Mm-hmm. I guess there's a common ground, which is if you take the path integral approach, you can take a finite quantum space-time region and do the path integral there. Mm-hmm. And now, there was the question whether we should define boundary Hilbert spaces. Now, one answer could be that, this is what I'm pushing you towards. One answer could be, no, forget about the Hilbert spaces. Just enumerate the path integral configurations and maybe categorize the configurations on the boundary. And in this way, we know at least conceptually how to do the path integral and how to study, how to compute probability amplitudes and then probabilities. So why?
We're not disagreeing, because that would completely be in line with the program on this slide. I was probably just saying that I don't know how to do it, but if someone knows how to do it,
this is what I'm pushing into.
That'd be great. Yeah.
This is a method. Would you agree this is how to do it?
Oh, I absolutely agree that we should just throw out the burden of Hilbert spaces. Whether we replace it with algebraic UFT or path integrals, I'm really agnostic about. But I'm definitely sure that Hilbert spaces are a baggage that we really do not need.
Okay.
We're not disagreeing at all.
Yeah, we definitely agree very strongly on that. Thank you.
Okay, very nice. Any other questions? Well, if not, let's thank Carly again.
Thank you.